The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to another Yes to Life show. My name's Robin Daly and I'm the show's regular host. And in the show, I speak to people involved in all aspects of integrative medicine for cancer. Everything from nutrition to lifestyle strategies and more. This week, I'm really delighted to have Sheila Dillon, presenter of Radio 4's Food Show, as my guest. Sheila has her own health story to tell, but she's a resolute campaigner for improvements to the way that cancer and other chronic diseases are dealt with by our NHS, notably, of course, in the arena of nutrition. I'm speaking to Sheila today over the phone. Sheila, thanks so much for joining us today for the Yes to Life show. I want to talk about some of the many issues surrounding diet and health.
Well, it's interesting to be here, Robin. I think Yes to Life is a fascinating organisation and I'm happy to do it.
Thank you. Okay, so you've achieved hero status with me for having asked some questions on public broadcasting that really weren't being asked and that desperately needed to be asked. I'm particularly referring to four episodes of the food programme, which are also available on the iPlayer, that you've broadcast over the last years, that are questioning such thorny topics as the relationship between diet and cancer, the role of sugar and refined carbs in chronic disease, and your most recent one, you had the temerity to question the government's dietary doctrine issued from the hallowed temples of science, the Eat Well plate. These programmes...
Eat Well guidelines now, they've moved on. It's no longer a plate, it's a guideline.
You're absolutely right, yes. So it has, yeah. Well, these programmes, they've clearly resulted from a personal interest in the area of food and health, which goes beyond your professional interests. In the case of cancer, you've initially linked this interest to your sister's experience many years ago. Would you start off by telling us a little bit about that?
Well, my sister is... she's a therapist. She has for many years worked with the dying and using different techniques and working with people with extreme disabilities. And so she's worked in the American hospital system for a long time.
Right.
And when she was diagnosed with a small cell breast cancer, i.e., it was throughout the tissue of one of her breasts. It wasn't a tumour. She was told that she must have a surgery. She must have her breast removed. But then she would need chemotherapy and radiation. I think radiation, certainly chemotherapy. Anyway, she went to a meeting. Her oncologist invited her to a meeting of other oncologists where he presented her case because she was already questioning what was being prescribed, and she listened to them all, what they would do, and 9 out of 10 of them, you know, agreed with her oncologist that she had to have chemotherapy or she'd die, but it wasn't very clear that she wasn't going to die anyway. But there was one young oncologist there, apparently, who said, but, you know, she's saying she wants the surgery, but not any of the follow-up treatments. And in fact, the prognosis for her kind of cancer is so poor that I'm not sure it's going to make much difference, really. So my sister decided after this meeting, she decided more or less before this meeting, but she decided definitely after this meeting that she was not going to have any follow-up treatment conventionally. And we were all very alarmed by this. So she had the mastectomy, and in fact she had her second breast removed because it was a kind of cancer that is highly likely to recur.
Right.
And then she told us all, you know, she was in California, we were in Britain, and we were all terribly, terribly worried. And she said, "I've been in the hospital system too long. I've seen people poisoned. They're not poisoning me." And she then consulted a cancer nutritionist, a specialist, and she went on a diet that was mostly plants and as organic as she could afford. And she took quite a number of supplements, I don't know what they were, to help that, with the advice of this person, this nutritionist who was on the end of a telephone line. It wasn't anyone near where she lived. And that was, oh gosh, it's now 20 years ago. And she's been fine ever since.
Fantastic.
It's, you know, and medically it's anecdotal. What can you say?
Well, quite.
But she was determined, and that was that. So that when I got cancer, when I got multiple myeloma in 2011, I thought, was I going to be as brave as my sister?
Hmm.
And the answer was no. But then again, with multiple myeloma, it's, you know, it's your bone marrow, and it's not quite so, you know, I don't mean my sister's decision was simple, it wasn't at all, but it was just, it was, mine was more complicated.
Hmm. Yeah, every case is different, and there's no rules here, are there?
No, I mean, you've got to, the thing that, you know, what you realise, as I'm sure you know, well, I know you know, is you've really got to use all your intelligence, and you've really got to get involved. There's no way of handing it on to someone else. You've got to do your own research. You've got to be critical. You've got to read things skeptically, because there's a lot of rubbish on
right.
the web. You've it's hard work.
I would agree it is. I'm just interested, you talked about your own decisions as to whether you'd have the courage to follow your sister. And with hindsight now, are you feeling you regret your decisions in some way, or do you think actually, you know, looking at things overall, that was the best way to go?
I think I don't think I'd change my decision. You know, I've used a mix of the conventional chemotherapy. My husband, who's an investigative journalist, investigated the person I should see before I actually saw the oncologist. So, and you know, that the decision was pretty, all the people he talked to, it was pretty clear I should see this particular man, who's, you know, an NHS consultant at Barts Hospital. And I don't regret that. He's very open-minded. He's the man who wrote the article in BMJ Patient Reports last summer about another patient of his that I know, you know, on high dose, who was moved from being untreatable to being completely stable with multiple myeloma, you know, on high doses of curcumin. And he's open to what works.
Good to hear. Well, that's great. And, you know, I think, as we were just saying, it's different in every case. And you've got to be very canny, as you said. You've got to actually be prepared to look at the things that are being offered, the things that are maybe being offered elsewhere, and weigh them all up and see, well, what's actually going to be the right thing for me?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And it's, you know, some of the things are difficult because you're at a low ebb in your life.
Yes.
You know, you're shocked and, you know, changing your diet, for instance, you know, drastically, which you feel you may have to do. I mean, I didn't change mine that drastically. But, you know, you don't feel like it.
I understand, yeah.
And then the problem is the whole weight of medical opinion is that it doesn't matter. You know, my first experience of chemotherapy over 4 months, you know, going whatever what it was, 3 days a week to the hospital to, you know, have infusions and drips and injections and so on. Was, you know, you'd sit in your chair, you know, watching these your poisons drip into your veins, and hoping they were doing you good, or at least killing off the cancer. But you watched people eating and drinking, you know, awful things, and being reassured that, you know, it was perfectly all right to eat junk, and you know, it would make no, you know, it's fine, and a balanced diet, you know, have another Coke and Lucozade, and I just thought this is madness, actually. This is real madness.
Well, nice to hear you say so. That's definitely one of the things I'm going to talk about a bit more later. Okay, well, thank you for all that. Coming back to your four programs, the issue that kind of threaded through them all and kept coming up, which is the one that I consider to be the overarching and fundamental issue in medicine, is its primary motivation. And so I contend that a system that puts profit first and people second inevitably gravitates towards expensive, relatively ineffective, patentable solutions. And on the other side, it kind of inherently excludes cheap, natural, effective ones. So I want to talk over many different issues that your program highlighted, but along the way to see how these maybe relate back to this primary issue of the money. The first of the shows that you put out that I'm referring to was the one about the relationship between diet and prostate cancer, featuring Jeff Tansey. It was a groundbreaking program, that one, definitely. And one of the things that was demonstrated by many of the responses was the pretty much universal disinterest in nutrition by the forces of medicine. And that contrasts starkly with what is a quickly developing public interest in this area. So, you know, that was a few years ago. Do you think the situation's improved at all in that time?
I think it's changing. You know, we're talking about a medical paradigm. I don't think it's merely a profit, you know, a profit-based system. That I think, you know, that's part of it. But we've had, since the Second World War, a belief in technology and yes, in drugs, in the power of, you know, it's a model which discounted other elements, you know, how you live, how you eat, how you exercise, how you sleep. You know, that model has took hold and, of course, has, you know, has fed into the creation of these giant pharmaceutical companies and, you know, the way we do research. But what I see is the paradigm beginning to fracture. Because medical students now, I mean, we'll come to this, I'm sure you'll ask about this program, but what we found in a recent program, talking to medical students at Bristol and Cambridge and other universities, is that they are highly dissatisfied with the curriculum.
Good.
That they're being taught, because they see when they are, particularly when they're doing their training, when they're doing their work experience, that they are faced with diseases that really are not amenable to the, you know, antibiotic, infectious, you know, our model was based on, you know, infectious diseases.
Yes.
You have a drug and, you know, we develop antibiotics and they're utterly brilliant and people don't die and it's marvelous. But we're now faced with most of the cases that a doctor will see in a day, or most of the cases that end up in hospital, are not those kind of diseases. They're ones that are to do with how we live. And it was fascinating to see how, you know, they get it. They just think that what they have said is, you know, we're not being equipped to deal with what we are going to be faced with as doctors, and they're actually doing something about it. You know, there's an organization called NutriTank, which was set up by two medical students at Bristol.
Right.
And, you know, and you've got these breakout doctors like Rangan Chatterjee
yes.
and Asim Malhotra.
Yes.
And, you know, I went to Rangan Chatterjee's first teaching day, approved by the Royal College of General Practitioners in London a few months ago, you know, which is about how to integrate these ideas into general practice. So I think what we're seeing is the gradual, painful breakup of a model. And I, I'm optimistic that, you know, 10 years' time, things will be different. And things are changing in the United States. I mean, there.
I know.
There's, yes, yeah. Definitely. I mean, you know, you look at what they're doing at kind of research at UCLA and Stanford, and you know, you see. I mean, it's difficult because it's a paid model. It's, you know, so if you're rich in the United States, you can buy anything you want.
Mm. Mm.
And it's, you know, it's, that adds another level of complexity. But anyway, I think we're seeing the breakdown of a model. I'm repeating myself.
Mm. Okay, well, that's very interesting. I hadn't heard of NutriTank. That was the right name, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've not heard of that. I've heard of Ron and Chastity, of course. But that's very interesting. I'm very glad there's all this discontent in the ranks. That's just what we need. And it is very instructive to look at what's happening in America as opposed to here. I mean, I thought a lot about why it's so different over there. They are literally at least a decade ahead of us over there in terms of embracing lifestyle medicine, I think. And
yeah.
I think it is the medical model that is the difference, is that the paid for model has actually got more flexibility in it. You know, if you do something which patients like and it works for them, well, you do it, you know. And the ability to change the NHS, this huge super tanker, is a much bigger deal. And so
it's very difficult. Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, so yeah, all very interesting. So,
but before we move on, you know, that
sure.
Prostate cancer
yes.
program, which you know, that you have Dr. Margaret Raymond at University of Surrey, who wrote the book. You know, it's a
yes.
recipe book, but it's also pulls together all the research linking diet and prostate cancer.
Yes.
And yet, you know, in spite of what it shows, it has, you know, it's, I think it's just a very slow burn, and it relates to, you know, the breakdown of the model. But it's, at the minute, you know, the NHS super tanker can't sort of take on board this, the fact that there is this research. It does show good links. It's, you know, that's very frustrating.
Mm. Yeah, well, the call generally is there's no evidence. That's what the normal response is. And, of course,
there's no evidence.
Year by year, it becomes less and less true as there's more and more evidence. And it's clear that it's a fixed position that there's an unwillingness to change. And, you know, it rather upholds the old adage about needing one generation to die off before you move on in science, which is tragic because, of course, there's huge number of people's lives are at stake meanwhile. I'm not sure what we can do about it, but I think, as you say, there is a younger generation coming up who already embrace these ideas, and it doesn't make sense to them not to include them.
Yeah.
Okay, so, yes, the 2013, you put out Food, Cancer and Wellbeing, and you opened it with a rather startling and classic exposition of the oncologist's view of nutritional medicine, like blowing out candles on your birthday cake when the house is burning down. So this was a shock to you as well at the time. And to me, it sounds a lot like saying to a 60-a-day smoker, well, you've got lung cancer now, so you may as well carry on with the ciggies. Dismissive and unscientific attitudes to nutrition, they're kind of endemic in medicine and research. But I'd contend they commonly go beyond dismissive in oncology. They're often aggressively anti-nutrition. So I wondered whether you agree with that, and if so, what's going on? Why is oncology singled out as being so anti-nutrition?
It's a good question, although we made a program that you probably didn't listen to a few years before about arthritis, and you know, rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes.
There's just as much hostility there. It's just that rheumatoid arthritis doesn't have the sort of central, emotional, terrible, you know, frightening place in the
right.
in our consciousness. I mean, it was, you know, there is very good evidence that over 50% of rheumatoid arthritis patients can be made pain-free and symptom-free by manipulating their diets. But, you know, there's barely there are some, but there's barely a arthritis specialist in Britain who would tell you that if you went for treatment. But I think cancer is, I don't know, I'm not sure I have the answer of it. It's, it has something to do with its, you know, the terror of cancer, and
right,
and that there's only one way. I mean, you don't read the history of the treatment of cancer, and you know, these people whose you know, more natural, more complex ways of dealing with it, you know, with the way they were blocked and made into pariahs.
Yes.
I mean, it is a disturbing history.
It is very disturbing. And yeah. It's a curious thing that you know, on the face of it, that you I think in this show, somebody said, it might have been you, that basically there's nothing to lose with good nutrition. There's no minuses about it. So why on earth would you discourage it, you know, in somebody who's interested? That people are sort of actively, oncologists seem to actively seek to put people off from worrying about their nutrition. And even if the evidence was considered poor by their standards, there's some. There's no getting away from the fact that there's some. So you might as well try it. It can only make you better. So it doesn't make a lot of sense, really. That's the thing for most people.
I mean, I've thought about it. It's interesting. My oncologist is someone who I was really interested to learn this. He did a degree in English before he went to medical school.
Yes.
And I think one of the problems we have in Britain, besides the NHS supertanker and, you know, the conformity and terror and of, you know, doing anything different, is that you take these kids straight out of school and you put them into medical school, and you then almost continue the A level. You know, it's not a medical degree is not meant to make you think. It's meant to make you learn a set of protocols and of, you know, of, you know, biology and physiology. But it's not a degree that, you know, I mean, these young students are challenging that, but it's not about making you think. And so you do have this class of people who've gone through this training, which is like a very, very complex engineer's training, who've never had cause to question what they're being taught.
Hmm.
You must have read that story this week about Harvard, that some of the medical students at Harvard were questioning how they were being taught about statins.
Yeah.
And that they were being, one of the professors was, you know, just teaching them that statins were marvelous. And then one of the students went and looked up where this guy was getting his money from. And he was getting his money from the pharmaceutical companies who make statins.
Right.
And so they were never, you know, they weren't being taught that there was another position. You know, maybe it's a wrong position, but there is other research which questions the value of statins. Mm. And I do think it's important, and it's, you know, that's not the way it is in the United States and in a lot of other countries. I mean, you can't start medical school until you've actually done some thinking, done another degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is interesting. And interesting to hear you mention that actually the financial incentive had got in there into the education of doctors. And, of course, well, it shouldn't be there. It's nothing to do with science. And it's nothing to do with the best outcomes or the best protocols. It's just to do with selling a particular idea. Yes, yeah, so one of the things that I've noticed going alongside this active disinterest in nutrition is what's happened to exercise. Now, exercise, interestingly enough, has been, in my eyes, quite quickly adopted as a good idea. You know, some evidence came out to show that it actually has an effect that's larger than quite a lot of very expensive drugs. And in no time at all, it seems like that's being brought in. And it, I've thought about, well, why on earth is nutrition so frowned upon, and why is exercise so easily adopted? And do you have any thoughts on that? I've had some, but have you thought?
Well, I think it's a lot less threatening, isn't it? You can just say, well, you know, you have to do the, you know, you do the drugs. You know, it doesn't really affect the medical model, exercise, very much. I mean, it, you know, it will help, and it does help. But it's not seen as sort of the substitute. You know, this conception that that it's a substitute for drugs. You know, there was a really stupid column in The Guardian 2 or 3 weeks ago by a Spectator writer, you know, which it was the usual attack on them. It was a study, I think it was in The Lancet or New England Journal of Medicine, based on a study, which showed that the people who had ticked a box saying they'd done complementary therapies were more likely to die.
Oh, yeah.
it was a terrible study. Rubbish. And the column does what those columns always do, which is to assume that the people who do complementary things are stupid.
Yes.
You know, that they just follow any guru, you know, they drink carrot juice and, you know, that they're complete idiots, that they don't look at the research.
Yes.
I'm wandering off from your question. You were saying, why
exercise is okay, yeah.
Than nutrition. Ooh, I don't know. I think it is seen as less of a challenge to the drug. The drug model.
Well, I think
that's not a complete explanation.
Yeah, well, I think that is a part of it for sure. And the other part that comes to mind is that there aren't any large corporations involved in exercise particularly, whereas food, of course, is another story. And there's, what is a healthy food and what isn't a healthy food is something that's tussled over big time behind closed doors and in public. So that's a major issue and much more contentious, if you like.
Yeah. Well, we've seen that when the Obamas, tried to talk about childhood obesity and the attacks on Michelle Obama for promoting a diet, lots more fruit and vegetables, organic,
Yeah.
You know, that she got tremendous stick for that and she swiftly moved to exercise. Because, as you say, there really aren't any corporations who are going to be deeply offended by that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So sticking with the food, another obvious way in which medicine's become shockingly divorced from the common sense connection between health and nutrition, again, something you talked about in your programs, is the food they serve in a hospital and that they allow to be sold in hospitals. Is such a glaring anomaly. It would be hilarious if it weren't so tragic. There have been a lot of attempts to change this, but not that much progress. There's no excuse for selling junk food or serving ready meals in our hospitals. So the only reason it's happening is because there are forces at work making sure it's still happening. What do you think?
We've created a monetized society. Money and profit margins and those are the key things. That's accountants run everything. They run hospital trusts. And if you are working, you're an NHS, the NHS and the BBC, the last redoubts of a world that hasn't been totally monetized here. And if you are, you put accountants in to run things because they're supposed to be so efficient. They look at a hospital and its services, and they see food as the place where things can be cut. Nobody's going to die, or not often, because you're serving lousy food. And this takes place in a culture which says, which for a long time has said food is trivial and it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think food's important. I mean, one of the reasons that there's better people, scientists and researchers speculate that there's better survival rates in Southern Europe is that, that just cultures that take food more seriously and that you feed people better when they've got cancer. But you've got this Thatcher Reaganite, we built this world now, and so hospital meals are marginal for those people, and then we've got a private finance initiative. The way that we've financed our hospitals has put our grandchildren and great grandchildren will be paying those debts.
Mm.
So, all the hospital trusts are in fantastically deep debt, and so you know, putting a McDonald's and a Costa, et cetera, in your hospital is a way to make some money.
Yes.
It's an economic thing.
Yeah. Well, you actually, I think it was a question you asked somebody. They came back with telling you that there was actually, in the contract, there was an agreement to bring the trolley around with sweets, crisps and chocolate to the bedside the day following a heart operation.
Yeah, that was a North London hospital. I mean, because it was in the past, it was very difficult to check on that, but it was on whether that was actually in the contract, because we couldn't find the contract.
Oh, right.
It was the doctor who had been working in that hospital who said that was the way it was. And certainly the trolleys, you know, were filled up at W.H. Smith's in the hospital lobby. And it's perfectly normal. I mean, you know, I see it at bars. You know, you load up your trolley and with everything, every junk, bit of junk you can think of, and toddle around. And the people who are toddling around with the trolleys are the nicest people. You know, they come to the bedside and,
I know.
You know, how are you, love? And, you know, and they're incredibly kind. And you feel like a wretch when, you know, you don't want a Lucozade and a Cadbury's fruit and nuts. And it's so normal. It's so normalized.
But when you just step back a little bit, and you can see the absolute lunacy of it, really.
Mm.
Mm. So here we're talking about sugar here, and you clearly had the establishment in the crosshairs in 2013 because you made two programmes that year which kind of hit out at these kind of issues, and you made a programme all about sugar and refined carbs and its effects on health. So many people would say the official advice is unscientific, it's massively destructive of public health, and it's just plain out of date. But probably the place where this issue about sugar has got the most polarised is in cancer. You know, it's still out there in CRUK's top 10 myths about cancer that sugar's got anything to do with it, despite the fact there's good evidence now to show that it not only promotes cancer, but it can even cause cancer. Well, as you point out, the patients in the top cancer hospitals, they're being actively encouraged to eat the sugary junk food to keep their weight on. So the cautionary principle is being completely tossed to the wind in all of this, given the evidence. The fact that they're taking absolutely no notice, you know, the fact that science is moving in a different direction, is putting a huge number of people's lives at stake. I suppose the question is, well, are we just going to have to wait for those people to die off? How's this going to move?
How is this quote, scientific, quote, attitude to sugar going to change, you mean?
Yes. I mean, you know, it has had an impact in other areas. You know, Robert Lustig's work and Asim Malhotra, they have made an impression, definitely, and they're being heard, I think. But in the world of cancer, it's still on fighting to the death to say, no, no, sugar and cancer, there's no problem.
Well, it's part of the same ignorance thing, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, what we talked about before, you know, this learned attitude that nothing counts but the drugs.
Yeah.
And they don't know anything. I mean, most doctors, when you talk to them, I mean, know absolutely nothing about diet. And what research there is about nutrition. I mean, they say all these things about sugar, but they're mostly parroting what you just said, you know, that this is one of the myths.
Yes.
I mean, it struck me very early when I was having my, you know, PET scan,
yes,
you know, which is the scan you ingest, you are given an injection of irradiated glucose, which then you sit and wait for an hour or so, and this glucose will show you where all the cancers are. And I thought, so you're telling me that sugar has nothing to do with cancer, and I could go on eating sugar, lots and lots of it every day, but you're actually using glucose to illuminate, because the cancer cells are all, you know, they're all feeding on this glucose that's just been injected into me, and you can see it because it's irradiated. And I thought, well, that's peculiar. But there is there, I feel like, sorry, step back a few points.
Okay.
I've just been reading Michael Pollan's book, and he says one of the things we can agree on, in defense of food is what it's called, he said all sides, you know, are disputing the role of food in health, is that before the Western diet took hold, we were all much healthier. I mean, we had infectious diseases, but, you know, that we're not the problems with obesity and diabetes and so on.
Right.
Well, we've now got to the point where apparently we can't all agree on that because, you know, there are these trolls and people who think they own the science on social media and people in the, you know, various medical establishments who think you have to have some sort of, you have to have a double blind study, large scale, to prove that sugar it has any deleterious effect on our general diets or any effect on cancer. And I mean, it's such an ignorant position. A, you couldn't do that on it would be almost impossible to do that kind of study.
Mm-hmm.
And so by talking about that, the need of these huge double-blind studies, you're basically cutting off any possibilities of progress in understanding. Because, and you know, and A, who would pay for that? Who would pay for such a study, even if it could be done?
Right.
There's no profit at the end. There's nothing you can patent. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning, you know, what's patentable? And what's patentable is that at the heart of so much of what's gone wrong with the research into cancer and other diseases.
Yes.
If it's not patentable, you don't do it.
Right, right. That's right. So it's quite interesting that the public are sort of, they kind of had enough of that argument of, like, you know, there's no evidence and, you know, taking matters into their own hands. I find the whole move of diabetes completely inspiring, where basically they've ignored entirely the government advice. They're doing something quite different. And at this point, I think tens of thousands of people have reversed a previously irreversible disease that needed more and more drugs every year. They reversed it in a matter of weeks. And still, they'll say there's no real evidence of a connection between carbohydrates and diabetes. Crazy stuff.
Yeah, I think it's crazy.
Yeah. But anyway, it's heartening that there is, you know, some ways out of these impasses of being, you know, the public are exploding out of the confines of traditional medicine.
Yeah, I think people are voting with their feet.
Yeah.
And people get more, you know, and the ones who think they own the science and you know, the science is this very narrow, you know, the science isn't inquiry, science isn't thinking, science isn't, you know, speculation. Science is only what we already know by these big studies. You know, it's sad, really.
It is pretty sad. Yeah, well, I was at the Food the Forgotten Medicine conference in 2016, a couple of years ago, when there was a presentation by one of the Eat Well team, one of its architects, and at the end of it, the slightly mischievous Dr. Phil Hammond, who was the presenter, he turned to the audience and he asked how many people thought that it was good advice. And one person put their hand up, and that was the colleague of the person who gave the talk. And everybody else, who of course was largely nutritionists, scientists, or all people who have got an interest in integrative medicine, thought it was bad advice, clearly, as they kept their hands down. So very interesting, isn't it, that there's such a schism between the advice that your guest on the show this year, Professor Leary, he robustly defended the evidence, you know, the proper high-level evidence that shows no connection between type 2 diabetes and carbohydrates. And it's amazing that we can have such a schism, isn't it, between where people are sort of robust interest by people who are, I mean, the audience that didn't put their hands up, these are not casual people. These are people with a powerful personal interest in health and well-being. And they think that the government advice is 30 years, 40 years out of date, basically, and actually wrong in this case. So that's quite a situation to find ourselves in, where our government's advising us to do things which are making us sick.
Yep. I mean, yes. I mean, I think schisms like this are not, you know, I think that's the way the world works. You know, there's accepted authority, and then accepted authority, you know, is under attack. And I mean, I think it's interesting that in that conference, Food the Forgotten Medicine, which I couldn't go to, that Phil Hammond asked that question, and that, you know, as you said, just one colleague put his hand up. The Western diet, as Michael Pollan says in Defense of Food, you know, has the unique, no other diet, in, as far as we know, in the history of the world, has ever made so many people so sick.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
I mean,
true.
People have been sick, and there have been epidemics and terrible things, but they weren't caused by diet. And there have been famines, of course, but, you know, an actual diet where people have enough calories that actually makes them ill. I mean, it's unique. We've been guinea pigs.
Yeah, yeah. This is a unique situation, and clearly out of control as well. It's a sort of runaway.
If you've got to keep making money, you've got to sell more food, and, you know, you've got to press this, the Western diet, you know, more further out. You know, more and more people must be involved in it. Because you've got to buy your food.
Yes. So one of the things you pointed to on that program, you questioned Professor Leary about, was the fact that there are food industry representatives on the Eat Well panel. And, you know, you said...
Advisors, the Eat Well panel, and, yeah.
Advisors, yeah. And he again robustly defended the fact that, you know, it was all transparent. And so, I mean, it was ever thus. There's always been, business has always been involved in all the regulatory bodies and all these kind of areas. But, okay, maybe it's more transparent, but it doesn't seem to be any less acceptable. You know, that's the thing that's very obvious to the public. It's like, well, why are they there? You know, it's kind of an obvious question, which I think you were asking.
If it's a scientific thing, what's the food industry doing?
Yes, they could have no other role other than to sort of dumb down anything that rather attacks the profits of the food industry.
Well, we have the British Nutrition Foundation, which most newspapers in this country and most broadcast organisations refer to as an independent research organisation. It's totally funded by the food industry, and then government gets involved, you know, paying for certain projects. But it's basically a food industry organisation. And, you know, that may be perfectly legitimate, but we ought always to say that.
Yeah, quite, yes, it's definitely not independent. I mean, you know, there was, if we look at in the area of tobacco, for years there was the Tobacco Research Council, set up again by the tobacco industry, which, you know, you can look back now and you can see that for decades they were busy confounding the science and trying to produce as much doubt as possible about the role of smoking with cancer. And it looks a bit similar with the food, I must say.
Oh, I think there are plenty of people in food policy who would say that the food industry, especially the junk food part of it, they're doing the tobacco playbook is the one they're following.
Right.
I mean, I think there's no doubt. I mean, the Coca-Cola emails that came out in the United States, the WikiLeaks dump.
Right.
You set up dubious organizations that sound like they're acting on behalf of the consumer, and you use some dodgy science, and you interpret science. You know, you confuse the science. You try and create as much confusion as possible.
I think that's it.
That's certainly been done about sugar.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, Sheila, I'm afraid that's about all we've got time for today. It's been fascinating to go into these issues with someone, you know, like you. You've got such a deep, both professional and personal interest in the area. So thanks very much. Really interesting. And a personal thank you for the work you've done and will no doubt carry on doing, bringing these anomalies right into the public arena. I think it's only increased awareness that will ever bring about change.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Robin. I mean, it's, I'm a journalist. That's what journalists are meant to do. They're meant to be sceptical.
They are.
And we do our best.
You certainly do. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye, Robin.
I'd encourage you to take the time to listen to the episodes of the food programme that were referred to in the interview. You can find links to them, along with links to other material mentioned in today's show, on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk, and click the show logo that's on the homepage. At the end of September, there are two events being put on by the charity Yes to Life. Healing with Painting and Playing with Colour is on the 26th. And there's a Willida Pampa workshop on the 28th. The events are very low priced, and there's even a deal if you want to go to both. Check out these events on the Yes to Life website or Facebook page. And you may also want to find out about the Yes to Life 10K, which has its own website at yestolife10k.org. That's yestolife10k.org. The run's on the 6th of October. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed the show and will be able to join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye. Thank you.